It takes a lot of effort for a child to raise a farm animal, and it takes a lot of emotion for the child to see his or her animal taken into the marketplace. That it takes so much from children leads us to ask, should children be allowed to work on a farm?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned to the 1017th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Paphos who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Hello, how to you, sir?
Folks, some time back, the giant Nestle company was accused of using child labor to produce its chocolate. Bad, bad Nestle, right? But before we go on boycotting Nestle, let's consider this issue of child labor on the farms. My good friend John, who manages the local county fair, told the following story that is very sadly illustrative of our times. Before the county fair opened for its annual event, John brought out a parcel of young lads from the local youth authority to clean and prepare the fairgrounds for its opening day festivities. The lads happily volunteered to work because it gave them a chance, a temporary chance, to escape the confines of their correctional facility. As the fair was to start in a few days, John gave the youth their instructions, turned them loose to their chores, and then went about his many management tasks. But after a while, John looked up from his task and realized that all the lads had disappeared. Concerned, he went looking and soon saw them all gathered around a corral at the 4-H barn. Thinking something amiss, John hurried up to the barn to see the cause of the gathering. What he found was that his miscreant lads were watching in wide-eyed wonder as a young 4-H lass milked her cow. Obvious to John from the wonder in the eyes of the lads was the fact that they were, for perhaps the very first time, learning about the source of their milk. John's story leads us to ask, should children be allowed to work on farms of family and friends, or should they be kept in school? Here to help us search for an answer, we have Kira Butler. Kira is the author of Raise, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids and How Its Lessons Could Change Food and Agriculture Forever. Kira, welcome to the Food Chain.
Michael, thank you so much for having me.
So pleased to have you aboard. So you're a writer for Mother Jones, right? Senior editor there?
That's right, I am.
And a big city girl?
Hey, that's also correct.
So big city girl writes a book about 4-H. Now, what was your epiphany moment, Kira, when you were walking down the street and decided, oh my goodness, I'm going to write a story about the 4-H?
Well, it had to do with some turkeys that my friends and I were raising in Berkeley, California. We had kind of been bitten by the urban farming bug, and we had some chickens, and that was going pretty well. So we decided, why not get a few turkeys? We didn't really know what we were getting ourselves into because these turkeys required a little bit more care than the chickens. They needed to eat protein every day. We had no idea what to feed them. We were feeding them canned tuna, and we just were way over our heads.
Filet mignon for the turkeys, right?
I'm telling you. So I happened to go to the county fair around this time, and much like the kids from the correctional facility in that great anecdote that you just told, I was captivated by the 4-H'ers. And I happened upon the small animals barn where I saw a kid who could not have been more than 7 years old with his prize-winning turkey. And he had this whole informational poster about exactly how much protein this turkey needed. The turkey looked beautiful. And I thought, wow, if this kid at age 7 knows more about raising turkeys than I do at age 31 or whatever, then clearly I'm missing something here, and I have to find out more about this 4-H organization. And so I did. And when I looked into its history and when I started meeting some of the kids who were involved in 4-H and the 4-H leaders, I was just hooked.
Before you go on, tell us about butchering the turkeys, because that's really kind of another story in itself, along the same lines as I told.
Yeah, so we are, our little neighborhood was very urban in Berkeley, and we planned to slaughter our turkeys right before Thanksgiving. The plan was that we were going to slaughter these birds and then eat them for Thanksgiving. And somehow, word got around among the neighborhood kids that we were going to do this. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but the day that we were set to do it in our across-the-street neighbor's backyard, like, a group of maybe 10 kids showed up, and they showed up kind of in groups, like on bikes, and they gathered around the yard, and they had heard that something was going to die, and they were so morbidly curious. And so my friends and I kind of freaked out. We were like, can we really do this in front of these kids? Are they going to be traumatized? Do we have to ask their parents? But the kids weren't going anywhere, and we kind of had a job to do. So, you know, we ended up doing this whole process in front of the neighborhood kids. And it was an interesting thing to watch, because some of these kids had never really thought about before where the turkey on their Thanksgiving plate came from. And they had these amazing questions. And they, you know, they got...
What kind of questions? What kind of questions?
Well, one of them said, you know, is it going to hurt when the turkeys die? Another one said, you know, can I pet it? Is it soft? They were just, you could sort of see the wheels turning in their heads as they made the connection between the birds that they were seeing, the live birds, and the meat that was going to be, well, not the exact meat, but the kind of meat that was going to be on their plates later.
So it's very similar to the young miscreants that were cleaning up the county fairgrounds. You know, they're looking and watching the milking of a cow, realizing perhaps for the first time that, oh, my goodness, that's where milk comes from.
And it really is, yeah.
And these children. Now, you and I both have these stories as to the extent of our ignorance. But they're not just isolated stories, are there?
No, and in fact, when I was looking into this concept of food literacy and agricultural literacy, I found that there have been many, many studies done on the state of ignorance of not only American children, but also American adults about where our foods and our fiber, our clothing comes from. And kind of an example of this was that a few years ago, there was a study done on kids and what they know about where food comes from. And there was an 11-year-old who was asked in this one study, what are brown cows for? Or, you know, what do brown cows do? And she said, well, I think they make chocolate milk. And this is not uncommon, you know, that, I mean, it's kind of a funny example, but like,
that actually happened. I thought it was an apocryphal story, but it actually did happen.
It really did. This was in an academic study.
So it was recorded and observed, and oh my goodness, that. But it's not just children. You cite examples of adults as well.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, in addition to kind of this veil of mystery that is around the origins of our food, adults have these kind of very stereotyped and almost, you know, comic book like. Images of what farmers are. If you ask an adult, you know, there are a lot of studies about this, that they'll say, oh, you know, he wears overalls and he's a man in his, you know, 50s and he's got a piece of straw hanging out of his mouth. And anybody who's hung around actual farmers knows that that's not exactly the reality.
You know, in writing my book, Metro Farmer, went and looked up the word for farmer. And in the it's really interesting if you go to the Webster's Third and look at some of the deeper meanings like farmer, 4A, ignorant, rustic, yokel, bumpkin, clumsy, stupid fellow, a green hand,
oh, wow.
Inexperienced,
yeah.
Or incompetent at the trade at which he is working. You know, you'd think that would get erased from the memory, but it's actually not, is it?
Not at all, no. I mean, people have no idea about the breadth of the agricultural industry in the United States. They don't know that there are scientists and engineers working toward bringing us our food and our fibers.
So it's kind of lost for us who live in the city. We have no contact with those who grow our food. We lose track. We don't know where our milk comes from. We think brown cows make chocolate milk. And oh my goodness, where is this going to take us? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here with Kira Butler, who is the author of Raise, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids, and How Its Lessons could Change Food and Farming Forever. When we come back, we're going to talk about 4-H. Wonder, what the heck do those 4-H's stand for? Do you have any idea? I think I know. We're going to talk about what lessons that children are taught in 4-H and the societal forces that are acting upon 4-H, like they are other organizations like the Boy Scouts and whatnot. This is the Food Chain. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Got to thinking about how little we know about what goes into our food, and a great illustration of that was in the book Raise by Kira Butler, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids. You know, in thinking about the children and their visions of chocolate milk coming from brown cows and their incredible ignorance they have, why should they know? Who's teaching them? In schools, and Kira talks about an interesting study by Oregon State University in interviewing school teachers about what they know about food and agriculture. Well, Kira, what did they know?
Well, they didn't know a whole lot. You know, this was one of the studies that I talk about in the introduction of my book, where people just rely on stereotypes of farmers when they're talking about what they imagine farmers to be, and they also they don't when they are asked to imagine where some of their food came from, it turns out that they really have never given it any thought.
And if they don't give it any thought, I guess they have nothing to impart to the school children they're supposed to be teaching.
That's right. And it's not really part of their directive either. This is not, food literacy is not part of the American curriculum today in the same way that it was, you know, 100 years ago.
Well, let's turn to the 4-H. Kira Butler, as a professional writer, you're a senior editor for Mother Jones. You target the 4-H clubs. By golly, I'm going to look into this. How does a professional writer pick up a subject, then what do you do when you start targeting and thinking, by golly, I'm going to take this subject and work it? What do you do as a professional writer?
Well, I always start with talking to the people who are most closely involved with it. And in the case of 4-H, that meant getting to know some kids. So I made contact with some of the local 4-H clubs. And I set about going to meetings and talking to parents and talking to club leaders and identifying some of the kids who were most kind of exemplary of what 4-H is about. And this was an interesting task because with kids, you know, you could have a 4-H'er who's really great and, you know,
sure,
does a great job raising animals, but also maybe isn't quite mature enough to talk about what it is that they get out of 4-H. So it was kind of, you know, to find the kids who both had the expressive language abilities to kind of describe to me.
They're still, kids, right?
Right, exactly.
And, what was it, the seven-year-old that was raising a turkey that you talked about?
Yeah, right. So, you know, a seven-year-old might be great at raising a turkey, but not so great at describing to a reporter what raising the turkey entails or what they're getting out of it emotionally. Mm-hmm.
So you selected kids with whom you could communicate.
That's right, I did, yeah. And mostly those were older kids. These were teenagers that I spent the most time with.
Mm-hmm. What about parents?
The parents were great. I became very close with a number of 4-H families. And, you know, these parents, you won't meet any more dedicated parents anywhere than these parents who are, you know, driving their kids to where the goats live and, you know, taking their kids from club meeting to practice to club meeting. It was just wonderful to see.
Mm-hmm. Now, 4-H, do you know what the 4-Hs stand for?
Yes, I do. So I would like to share with you the 4-H pledge.
Good.
Who spent time in 4-H that will be very familiar. I pledge my head to clearer thinking, so that's the first H, my heart to greater loyalty, my hands to larger service, and my health to better living for my club, my community, my country, and my world.
Mm-hmm.
So the 4-H's are head, heart, hands, and health.
And there they are. Now, with respect to 4-H, how far back in our history as a country does this go?
Well, it goes back to the turn of the last century, right around 1902 or 1903. And it really has a fascinating history. So the club was developed by extension agents at the land-grant universities of the Midwest.
Wow.
And this was a time in American history where industrialization of farms was only just beginning to happen. And at the universities, they were discovering these new and more efficient ways to farm. They were experimenting with tractors. They were experimenting with spacing crops a certain distance apart in order to kind of maximize their uptake of soil nutrients. They were experimenting with using hybrid seeds. But these techniques were, they were different from the techniques that America's farmers were doing, the techniques that they had brought with them over from Europe generations ago. And the farmers were a little bit wary of these newfangled ideas that the universities had. So in order to win the trust of the farmers, the extension agents came up with a brilliant idea. They decided that they would start the club for the kids of the farmers. And they did things in these clubs like they would give the kids a little bit of hybrid seed and tell the kids, well, why don't you start your own plot? And then the parents would see how well that hybrid seed did. And they would say, huh, I think I want some of that for myself. And pretty soon they would be talking to the extension agents. So 4-H really was developed as a bridge between the universities and the community of farmers in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Has it changed?
Has that
core mission changed then?
I mean, I guess yes and no. It's changed in that, you know, you find 4-H today in all corners of the United States. You find it in agricultural communities, but you find it also in suburbs and cities. And today, 4-H's mission is much broader than just to, you know, teach people new farming techniques. It has to do with nutrition and healthy living, and leadership is a big part of it as well. And 4-H'ers are learning everything you can imagine, from robotics to, you know, GPS navigation to drama to video. You know, you can find 4-H'ers pursuing any activity possible.
Now, are 4-H clubs funded by the government still?
Yes, they are. So 4-H is housed under the USDA, but it also has a kind of a nonprofit arm, foundation arm, actually, called the National 4-H Council. And National 4-H Council does a lot of fundraising for 4-H.
Mm-hmm. And is the 4-H clubs under the influence of other elements, for example, corporate interests?
And I...
You
I
mentioned hybrid seeds, and, you know, that popped up an image in my head right away.
Yeah. So I address this in my book. 4-H actually receives funding from most of the major agribiz companies out there. Monsanto, DuPont, you know, Kraft Foods, Walmart at one point or another. And these companies, you do find their influence in the 4-H curriculum, and this is one of the most controversial pieces of 4-H today. One of the most interesting examples of that I found, I actually ended up traveling to Ghana, and I was hanging out with 4-H clubs there.
In Ghana?
In Ghana, yes. Mm-hmm. In Ghana, 4-H is sponsored by DuPont. And so the idea is that DuPont is providing hybrid seeds to these 4-H clubs.
Genetically modified hybrid seeds?
No, not genetically modified.
Oh, really? Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So the idea is actually quite similar to what 4-H clubs looked like in the United States at the turn of the century. The idea is that the kids in these farming communities in Ghana get these seeds for free and for their 4-H clubs, and they make these, you know, maize corn plots, and the adult farmers in the community see how well their seeds are doing, and lo and behold, they want to buy some. But the problem is that these seeds are very expensive, and the farmers in Ghana are very poor. And they also require a lot of chemical inputs, like, you know, pesticides and fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers and things like that. And so the dynamic that is happening is that these farmers want these seeds, but they're looking at a situation where if they get the seeds, then they're going to have to be wholly dependent on DuPont and other American agribiz companies year after year, because hybrid seeds, you can't gather the actual seeds at the end of the season like you can with conventional seeds. You have to keep buying these seeds. So you set up a dynamic in these communities.
First one's free. Here's a free taste, and then you're locked in, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Kira Butler. Kira, thank you so much for insight into the 4-H. When we get back, what lessons are taught by the 4-H? Do stay tuned. Well, you know, there was a time not too long ago when most everybody lived on farms, and we all learned the lessons of our lives from all of the living and dying that was going on in those farms. But then we all moved into town and got comfortable and live in our houses and kind of have no touch at all with our food anymore. Don't know where it comes from. Get to thinking that the chocolate milk we buy at the store comes from brown cows. Of course. Well, duh. Of course it does, right? So what about our children? You know, where are our children going to learn the lessons of their lives, the lessons they need to make intelligent decisions for the future of their families, the future of our country, if they have no way of knowing about the lessons of living? Where are they going to learn it? Are they going to learn it in school? You know, I think of the delinquent kids that were cleaning up the fairground and were looking at amazement at the cow being milked and realizing for the first time that that's where milk comes from. Well, they've been in school for a long time, but they had no idea about food, which is, if you think about it, one of the most important elements of life. And if we don't know anything about it, where the heck is that going to take us, Kira?
Well, that's the question that I ask in my book. You know, we are raising generations of kids who are so disconnected from where their food comes from that you wonder when they grow up and they become citizens who vote, whether they're going to vote in a way that prioritizes our land and farming techniques that restore the earth rather than take away from the earth. These are big questions, and they're important ones.
So that would kind of explain the influence being exerted by, you know, the federal government and by corporations on the 4-H club then. They're fighting for the attention of the future then, correct?
That's right. They are, and it's quite a battle.
Is the 4-H club put upon by other societal interests? I'm thinking in particular of the Boy Scouts and the struggle that the Boy Scouts are going through with those who want to see homosexual males as scout masters. And if it doesn't happen, they're going to, you know, force the Boy Scouts out of business. Is the 4-H organization under those same kinds of influences or pressures?
No, not on a national level. You know, one of the reasons that I heard from parents in the Bay Area about why they decided to put their kids in 4-H rather than Boy Scouts was that 4-H doesn't discriminate in that way. And one thing that's important to note about 4-H is that there's not a lot of national directive for what clubs do. So,
mm-hmm. So it's really kind of local then?
Exactly. The clubs really reflect the values of their communities. So, you know, people are really allowed to kind of shape their local 4-H clubs in the way that kind of makes sense to them, which a lot of parents and kids really, really appreciate.
So as a journalist, you're observing these kids. You're sitting in the stands with your laptop, observing, making notes. What kind of lessons does the 4-H club teach children about growing up and the lessons of life?
Well, one of my favorite lessons is the lesson of collaboration. You know, there's a motto in 4-H that is learning by doing. And so these kids are really, it's not like they're sitting at a lecture and hearing some grown-up drone on about how to raise your goat. These kids are getting hands-on experience and they are learning from other kids. So you know, if an 8 or 9 year old comes in and has never raised a goat before, a teenager's job is to teach that kid, you know, the basics of what it takes to raise a goat or a cow or a lamb.
That's a two-way street there. You know, one child is getting information and the other child is learning how to give information.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the idea, especially in these urban clubs and suburban clubs that I was visiting, the idea is that everybody works together to make sure that the whole club is taking care of the animals right. And, you know, it happens in agricultural communities where people have a little more space, that the kids will raise the animals at home in their yard or in their barn. But in suburbia, that's not really possible because not everybody has space and, you know, there are zoning laws against that kind of thing. So the clubs that I visited, the animals were raised in communal areas. Like, for example, in Oakland, the club had found this property up in the hills where everybody could go to raise their goats and the goats could live. So everybody took turns taking care of these goats and going up and making sure that the goats had enough to eat and that the goats were, you know, not getting into trouble. And it was wonderful to see the kids kind of learning what it takes to be part of a team that way.
So all kinds of lessons in interpersonal relationships just from taking care of a goat.
That's right. That's right. And it was wonderful to see also that the younger kids over the course of the time that I was reporting go from being total novices and in some cases even being kind of scared of the animals to really taking on responsibility and figuring out for themselves what it took to raise these animals.
And other lessons?
Well, another big lesson is failure. A lot of these kids, you know, they put so much into raising these animals. They not only, you know, feed and groom them every day, but they also spend time training them, sometimes hours every day. You know, some of these teenagers that I spent time with are really serious about 4-H, and this is really the main thing that they do. And in one case, you know, this young woman, Kelly, who raises lambs, she had, you know, put so much time and effort into raising her lambs and training her lambs. And then when she got to the fair, it turned out that the judge who happened to be there that day for the sheep show, preferred a different style of showing. He wanted, kids to do what's called sort of a low style of showing. And that has to do with how the kids brace the lambs. That's kind of a show move. And Kelly had not practiced this with her sheep. And she didn't end up doing as well as some of the other kids. And this was something that she just had to take in stride. But sometimes that happens. But despite your best effort, you know, somebody doesn't like what you're doing.
That's really interesting because most of the time that's what happens, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, it happens to us at work. You know, you have a coworker who you disagree with, and you just sort of get through it and move on.
Yeah, because if you fight the fact that you can't win all the time, then you can't lose. And if you can't lose, you can't win.
That's right.
And those are really tough lessons for kids to learn. But where else can they learn them? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, there's so much talk today about, you know, this idea of kind of helicopter parents and kids who are coddled too much and kids who are not given a chance to fail. And failure really does provide some really important growing opportunities for kids, or at least that's what I came to see after experiencing these very intense competitions at the county fair.
And this, when we get back, I'd like to ask about the competitions. Folks, this is the Food Chain. You're invited to participate, too, if you have any good 4-H stories or experiences or questions to ask Kira Butler, who is a senior editor at Mother Jones and also the author of Raise, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids, and How Its Lessons Could Change Food and Farming Forever. How on earth could that possibly happen? Do stay tuned. Got to thinking about the 4-H as being a contest as opposed to just raising animals. The kids are actually raising animals to contest them. Is that true, Kira?
Well, that's true for the kids who are raising animals. You know, I do want to emphasize that 4-H is much more than just livestock raising. But for the kids who are raising animals to take to the county fair, yes, the shows at the county fair are kind of the ultimate goal.
Well, but you also talk about the kids in Ghana and raising their fields of maize and whatnot, and how important, you know, their fields were. I suspect there was a little bit of competition going there as well.
Perhaps, yeah. There it's different. You know, there's no county fairs, and they weren't raising livestock. But, you know, these kids really, they took such pride in their maize plots, and they told me over and over how much they really valued the 4-H club and leaders for giving them this opportunity to plant these plots.
Well, how is it possible the title of your book is How, you know, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids and How Its Lessons Could Change Food and Farming Forever? That's a pretty big statement, girl.
Yeah, it's, you know, it really came from thinking about the fact that food literacy and agricultural literacy is not something that's taught in our schools. And yet, you know, we eat every day. We wear clothes every day. You know, these products that come from farms are things that we interact with. And if we do not have an educated force of voters and consumers, then we are going to be making decisions that that will affect all of us. For example, you know, what do we want to be putting into our land? Do we want to be restoring the land with farming techniques and inputs that that support the health of our soil? Or do we want to be extracting from the land by, you know, monocropping and putting a lot of chemicals into our land? You know, these are questions that you need to understand the basics of agricultural science and the basics of you know, engineering and, you know, a lot of these different concepts that go into farming in order to really make decisions about. And 4-H is one of the only organizations out there that is teaching kids these lessons.
You know, given the experience of the Oregon State University research in asking public school teacher questions about the, you know, where food comes from, and they don't know. They have no idea. And if they don't know, how are the kids to know? And, well, I guess what is interesting, if we don't know from where our food comes from or what is in our food, we're going to pretty much eat whatever they put in front of us, right?
That's right. That's the fear, yeah.
And if we eat whatever they put in front of us, it's going to be whatever gives them power and control and money. And us, well, who cares about us as long as we're fed and not complaining, I guess. There it goes. So it's interesting to see that. Why is it that it's just 4-H?
Well, That's a great question. I mean, I think that it reflects the values of our society a little bit. You know, food right now is, it's very easy not to think about it. You know, you go to the supermarket, you get your food, and nobody is requiring us to, you know, do the kind of exercise of thinking through, you know, well, do I want to buy this brand because it's produced in this way or that brand because it's produced in the other way? It's just, you know, it's made so easy for us not to think about it. And so, you know, with no impetus to kind of think that way, we're not doing it. And 4-H is really the only group out there that is instructing kids from an early age on how to think through those kinds of things.
And how do parents get tuned in to 4-H if that's something they're interested in?
Well, it kind of depends on the community. You know, in agricultural communities, 4-H is often a huge part of the community life, and that's still very much true today. In cities, there might not be a local 4-H club, but kids might encounter it through after-school programs or summer camps. And in suburbs, it might also be camps and after-school programs, or there might be a club where you don't raise animals, but you do other kinds of projects. It really varies from place to place, but a great place to start for parents who are interested is to look into their local agricultural extension, because the 4-H local programs are administered through the agricultural extension.
So those are county extension agents, and just go to your local county offices and look for the extension and ask them, and perhaps you can get the information you need, right?
That's right, yep.
So we're going to take a quick break here in a moment or two, but when we come back, I want to ask you, Kira Butler, as a big city girl, as a writer, as a professional, what you learned. I want to ask what the parents of the children that you worked with learned, and I want to ask about what happened to the children that you spent so much time observing, and you spent quite a bit of time observing them, did you not?
I did, yes, about 2 years.
So 2 years, and you've just followed them around in their various events and whatnot. You didn't hang around with the kids when they were out in the 4-H barns, did you?
Of course I did. I had to.
Okay, I guess that was always the envy of all the kids, is the 4-H'ers in the barns. Who knows? Yeah. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, boy, we got a call, of course, at the end of the show. We'll pick it up really quickly. But when we get back, I'm curious to know what Kira herself learned, what the children learned, what their parents learned about 4-H, about the lessons of life. And where on earth can we learn these lessons anymore? It doesn't seem like we're getting them in public schools, or so we're going to have to find someplace, or we're all going to be in deep doo-doo. So do stay tuned. What changes did 4-H effect give the children, the parents, and Kira Butler, the author of Raise, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids? But before we get to that, let's go to Dorothy, who has a comment and our question, perhaps, about 4-H. Dorothy, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hi. Yes, first of all, really wanted to compliment Kira for going to the source and getting the information that she got and trying to disseminate that information, because so few people really do know where our food comes from, and I really appreciate what she has done for 4-H. And secondly, a comment, my son is a master's in mechanical engineer, and he started out with 4-H. When he gave his master's presentation, I said, how did you learn how to give that kind of presentation? Because it was, of course, excellent. And he said, Mom, 4-H taught me everything I needed to know to be a success in what I wanted to do. And so I just wanted to pass that along and compliment Kira for what she did to introduce people to 4-H and how important it is.
Wow. Well, Kira, how's that for a segue? What about the kids? What did the kids learn from 4-H?
Well, that was such a great anecdote, and it's one that I hear over and over from parents of former 4-H'ers, parents of successful young adults who really they attribute their success to some of the things that they learned in 4-H. And, you know, these are both concrete things, like public speaking. 4-H really emphasizes public speaking, you know, for all of its members. And but also kind of the more abstract lessons, like what I was talking about before, in terms of collaboration, the importance of teamwork, you know, the importance of learning how to fail and taking lessons from that failure and moving on and doing better the next time. So, you know, the lessons that kids take from 4-H really are with them throughout their entire lives.
Okay, what about Kira Butler? What did Kira Butler learn for Kira Butler while she was watching all these kids?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I wish that that when I was growing up, I had had 4-H. I grew up in Somerville, Massachusetts, which is a city. It's very urban, and I didn't ever really have the opportunity to find out for myself where my food came from. You know, looking back at my childhood, I just think, wow, you know, what may I have done differently? Would I have decided to go into agriculture? You know, would I have developed an interest earlier on in food and farming, had I had 4-H? So, that was one of the kind of, big takeaways for me. But I also really, came to see 4-H as, an organization at a crossroads. You know, here we are, you know, with a rapidly expanding global population, and we have to figure out how to feed them. And 4-H is really the only organization that is teaching kids about where our food comes from, has this incredibly important role in educating kids about, you know, how farming works and how we're going to grow this food to feed all of these people on our planet. And is 4-H, you know, going to go in the direction that some of its sponsors might like it to go in? And is it going to kind of toe the food industry line you know, ever more monocrops, ever bigger plots, ever more chemicals? Or is it going to take a hard look at that system and challenge the young people of America to find, and America and the rest of the world as well, to find a better, more restorative way to grow our food?
And Kira Butler,
essential.
Kira Butler, thank you so much. Author of Raise, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids. Thank you so much. Folks, remember Mike Lowson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.